and welcome to And All Shall Be Well. My name is Megan Rohr, and I'm your host. Today, I'm having a conversation with Michael Nagler, who is a longtime nonviolent activist who works locally in the Berkeley area and Bay Area and all around the world with people who are interested in active nonviolence that helps to change the world for the better. In particular, Michael has a long history of working for peace and justice. He is someone who holds a lot of wisdom, and I really enjoyed having a conversation with, particularly in hard times like now. If you have ever been overwhelmed by the news or have felt discouraged by the ways that people are always angry and grumpy, or maybe you get angry and grumpy, Michael has words of wisdom, both to encourage you to center yourself in compassion and kindness for yourself and for others, and ways that you can transform some of those things the best you can and move forward with wellness into the future. Enjoy our conversation.
Thank you very much, and greetings, everybody. My name is Michael Nagler. In my day job, I was a professor at UC Berkeley, and while I was there, I started the Peace and Conflict Studies program, though I was a literature professor, basically, and I strayed from the fold. And the reason we started that program is I'm a passionate fan, so to speak, of Gandhiji, as you can see back here, Mahatma Gandhi. And I taught a course on Gandhi, the first time there had ever been a course on Gandhi in our university, is there any other that I know of. And it was very well received, had, you know, good turnout for a beginning course, 100 students. So I said, okay, great. You know, where do we put this course? And I took it to South Asia, and they said, no, it's not really our material. I took it to religious studies, and they said, no, you should try philosophy. And I spare you all the details that there was no room at the inn at the universities. I had to face a choice. I either abandoned the course, which was one of the most satisfying things in my professional career, and which I felt was very meaningful for the world, and we will be talking about that, I'm sure, in connection with wellness. And so we started this program to house the course, and at one point, it was the largest peace studies program in the country. And right now I work, where you're seeing me now is I'm in Petaluma, California, and this is the head office of the Mehta Center for Nonviolence. And our mandate that we've given ourselves is promoting nonviolence worldwide. That's what we do. We are basically an educational organization. And we have recently launched a program called the Third Harmony Project. And it consists of a book called The Third Harmony, and a film called The Third Harmony, and also a board game, which my friend and educational ED, Stephanie, who's not here right now, she often mounts game plays with the game. The game is called Cosmic Peace Force Mission Harmony 3. So this has been our focus, and we've been very happy with the way that it's been received. And that has been my gig, or as we used to say back in New York, my shtick for for quite a while now. Third Harmony was the fourth book that I've written on the subject of peace. Then I wrote some academic books before then. But the thing that, of course, really gets the most traction and the most visibility these days is the film, which is a 45-minute documentary. Are we all right, Megan?
Yeah, that's exciting stuff. And my kind of encountering you has come through many of my nonviolence projects that I've been up to, but also because of your work in Berkeley for a while. And yeah. You yourself have been a bit of a nonviolence legend in the world. Do you want to tell any stories of those days past, or?
Well, I can tell you a very recent one that I feel very good about. We have a radio program also, doesn't everyone? And we interviewed a member of the Israeli Knesset, a man by the name of Ofer Kassif, who at the moment was in Mexico on a meeting. And when he got back to Israel, he's very outspoken. He's against what's going on in Gaza, as any, reasonable human being would be. And he's against what led to it, the occupation and so forth. And we found out that shortly after he returned to Israel, there was an attempt to impeach him on the grounds of not being patriotic. And he came within 4 votes of being impeached. He basically scraped by. And one of the things that he used to demonstrate that he really was in favor of nonviolence and not against Israel or anybody else was our interview. So it's rare in this field when you can see a direct, concrete result of your work. And that gives me the feeling that there's other results going on out there that I'm not aware of. And since I'm absolutely persuaded, as you probably are also, Megan, that, as Martin Luther King said, we really don't have a choice meaningfully between violence and nonviolence anymore. The choice is between nonviolence and non-existence. So I'm on the side of nonviolence, and you are also, and it's very rewarding to have that repercussion, that impact.
Yeah, and it feels like it's such a wide divide these days.
Yeah.
Between those who believe that tearing everything down is the way to move forward, and those that sort of use a more active, creative nonviolence in the world and want to dramatize the ways that injustice exists, but not in a way that is trying to deflate the morality and humanness of other people. And for me, that kind of comes from this idea that if we harm others, it bounces back.
I just was listening to a long interview with a friend of mine out here in California, Norman Solomon, and it was pretty devastating about the, I won't go into the details, but about, all the war fighting that's going on and how our country is responsible for a good bit of it. And one thing that he emphasized very cogently is if you really think that you can cause injury to others without causing injury to yourself, you are seriously deluded. And I was just saying with a friend of mine that one of the positive developments in the last, well, this one is pretty darn recent, actually. The last maybe 10, 15 years is this concept of moral injury, meaning that when you are engaged in injuring other people, even if your government pats you on the back and says, good work, you in your heart know what you're doing and you get injured by that. And I know at least one psychiatrist, friend of the family, actually, who treated military veterans. This is quite a long time before we had even the term moral injury. And he said in his professional experience, nobody carries out war without being injured, without being traumatized. So the scientific outlook on what you were just saying, Megan.
Yeah, and I noticed that a lot when I was working for the police department to help with nonviolence work and with community chaplaincy work, that I think even the ways that there is domestic policing and first responder work carries a lot of that same moral moral injury, and that to be people who want to make sure it doesn't get passed along in unjust ways, there's sort of a I don't know if it's a duty, but it's a call for some of us to try to help repair those moral injuries so that it doesn't trickle down to other people, particularly those who are vulnerable.
You're so right. I mean, we often use the expression in nonviolence work and peace work more generally of breaking the cycle. Violence kicks over into other violence unless somebody can intervene, and the other person is not going to do it. So you have to intervene. And I'm firmly convinced that nonviolence and what we call constructive program, borrowing that term from Gandhi, is the most effective kind of intervention that we can carry out today. We have a resource on our website called the Roadmap. And it's three concentric circles, and the inner circle is taking care of yourself. The medium circle, the middle circle, is getting engaged in constructive program. You find constructive ways to work on the problem. Often that will solve the problem. If it doesn't, and only if it doesn't, then you go to civil disobedience or nonviolent resistance. And even that, of course, you're doing with love. And the key element is what you just said, that you do not have animosity towards the human beings. You may be absolutely dead set against what they are doing, but you are never against their welfare, their real welfare as a person. And that is what we think is the real heart of nonviolence work.
Well, I know that learning about nonviolence in my pastor training in my kind of early days in Berkeley helped me personally, because as a trans person, it's very easy for people in this world to imagine ill intent or imagine the worst in me. And so to have in myself a very strong continued discipline of nonviolence helps me to sort of outlast other people's fear lies that they have. And I see that same thing in Martin Luther King Jr.'s writings and other people who have been on different marginal spaces, whether it's being against colonizers, that there's this way in which people can try to dismiss everything you stand for or by imagining the worst in you. And so we have to live the principles even bigger, even when people are perpetuating violence in their words, in their gossip, or in their fists sometimes. So I see it as a powerful thing that can be helpful for people, even though it's not fair that people have to.
No, it's not fair. But what we can rely on is when we refuse to identify a person with the worst that they have done, that there's so much evidence now that does influence them. You may or may not see it. It may or may not be visible. That's why I have developed this concept called work versus work. I say nonviolence always works. It always works. It always influences people and the environment, but it doesn't necessarily work in the sense that it's going to do exactly what you want it to do. But, while you were speaking, I was reminded of this concept that is used very often in Central America, which is firmeza permanente, permanent firmness. You can, and Martin Luther King said this beautifully, we're going to outlast your hate with our love. And because ultimately love is real and hate is not, it will work. And we do have that great advantage to hold on to.
Yeah, the timeline isn't always in our control about when people notice the methods that sort of center us. But I have seen it work in the long run. In fact,
Yeah.
I think every single person who ever said negative things to me in high school has since apologized, but it took right?
That for me
is sort of this, like, I shouldn't have had to, like, live in ways that were big for the rest of my life for that to happen, but it does happen.
Yeah, it does happen. And it is obvious that if you insulted them back, it would not have happened. You would have been buying into their model. And that's one of the things that MetaCenter has really emphasized of late, that our, whether we choose violence or nonviolence, ultimately rests on what is our model of a human being and what is our model of reality. If we buy, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I really love this subject. If we buy into the commercial model that we're all separate, we're all physical beings, and we're all in competition, then we go to violence, and there's no way to stop that cycle. But if we recognize that a human being is mind, body, and spirit, and that on the level of spirit, we are really one, that there cannot be, you know, consciousness, another term for spirit, does not have a location in space-time, to use scientific language. You know, I have a mind in the sense that I have my thoughts and emotions. They're somewhat overlapping with you, considerably overlapping with yours, actually, but so with some differences. But on the level of consciousness, the enlivening spirit that keeps us alive, there's only one. And the more we're aware of it, the more nonviolence becomes unavoidable. And the more we can see how it works. And that's very reassuring.
Well, the thing I've always appreciated about the work of the MetaCenter is that you all don't expect people to be saints, right? And in fact, I think you highlight the ways that kind of imperfect or highly flawed people can still kind of make a consistent choice to try to come back to nonviolence. And I'm wondering if you would speak a little bit about that in case there's a couple people who are wondering if this is too highfalutin for their day-to-day life.
You know what? I bet there's more than a couple, because that is one of the two or three most common questions and objections that we get about nonviolence. One is that it's not human nature, and the other is that it doesn't work. And probably the third is that you have to be an illumined being or a saint or something like that to carry it out. But the fact is, we're doing nonviolence all the time, but we don't recognize it. The mass media, for example, the commercial media, they don't reflect it back to us. They don't act as that mirror picking up the best that's in human nature. So that's what we have, that's our responsibility, to do that ourselves, to see the best in ourselves and the best in other people. And to recognize that we start imperfect. And I know in my case, I'm probably going to also end imperfect, but better, better than when I began. And so nonviolence is definitely a learning process. For one thing, if you know how to do it well, it's a learning process in your actions. So you undertake a campaign, let's say it backfires, doesn't seem to work. You then go and ask yourself, okay, where was I less than nonviolent in this interaction? Sure enough, that person triggered me. I got mad and I shot something back at him or her. Shouldn't have done that. And so you internalize that lesson. You learn the feedback. And as the Dalai Lama himself said, if you lose, don't lose the lesson. So the beauty of nonviolence, or one of them, is that you can succeed even when you lose. Even when something doesn't work, when it seems to fail, you can derive benefit from it, improve yourself and your approach and your techniques and work it better the next time. And that's also one of the ways that this firmness, this firmeza comes in, that you're not gonna drop it just because it didn't seem to work.
I hear a lot from some folk that the hardest thing for them is that they get so angry, particularly with like family members who are good at pushing buttons or just seeing the news being so angry all the time.
Yeah.
What is your kind of advice for people for whom anger is a difficulty?
Yeah, another really, really good question. I think I would answer that on two levels. One is kind of, just as a kind of general principle, not to beat up on yourself because you were angry, not to feel that anger was a moral failure of some kind. Instead, just very scientifically, look upon anger as energy. And then ask yourself, okay, this energy has come up. I'm not going to say, you know, whether I like it or I don't like it. What I'm going to say is, how shall I use it? In what ways can I put this energy to work? And, you know, even if you watch Richard Attenborough's film about Gandhi, which had some shortcomings, there was one scene in there where you can see in Gandhi's face that he is very angry. He is tremendously angry. But he converted that anger into constructive work. Now, when you do this, you end up feeling better, but you don't necessarily become aware of the transference of the process. I mean, this has happened so many times with me. I get really angry about some injustice, and I do something about it. At least I write something about it without, you know, being venomous against people. I look for alternatives. And sure enough, at the end of the process, I feel better. And the only explanation is that that anger energy has converted itself into positive energy. I said there were two things I was going to say, but I can't remember the other one. So.
It's a good demonstration that we're not all perfect, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's very handy in that regard.
One of the ways that I sort of had been taught in my nonviolence journey to transform anger was to try to think about satyagraha.
Yeah.
And that beautiful principle sort of that Gandhi uses to talk about connecting with your life force or your soul force and trying to get a really deep connection with whatever it is that helps to fuel you and center you so that when other opposing forces of negativity come at you, you've sort of gotten this ballast. How do you try to sink into your satyagraha?
Thank you so much, Megan, because that's the part of my answer that I forgot. Yay. I happen to be a meditator. I have a spiritual practice. I meditate a lot, regularly, every day, every night. And I find that as a result, I am a less angry person, not in the sense that I don't get angry, outraged. I get even more outraged. But it's not the kind of anger that eats me up. It's not demoralizing. It doesn't make me sick. And we know that anger will do that if you don't find a creative outlet for it. So that is exactly the process that Gandhi entered into and that he called satyagraha.
I'm glad we were in sync.
Yeah. Glad but not surprised. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So meditation for me has been, you know, extremely important. And in addition to teaching the nonviolence course at Berkeley before I retired, which I did kind of early, I taught a course on meditation. And I don't know how, you know, I keep hearing from students who took it 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and sometimes they'll say I'm still meditating or sometimes not, but it's often, you know, been very helpful for them. And I know that it's been very helpful for me.
You are also someone that I know to be very connected, particularly I like to think of you as someone who like connects hopeful people who are doing work in the world. And I'm particularly for people who might only be like finding terrible things in their news feeds and their scrolls. Yeah. What are some stories or people that you think people should be paying attention to where hopeful things are kind of bubbling in the world?
Yeah. In that second conversation, we had a second conversation with this man, Ofer Kassif, that I mentioned, the Knesset member, and we connected with Mubarak Awad, who is a Palestinian, who started the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence, and Ella Gandhi, who is Mahatma Gandhi's granddaughter, and myself and Ofer. And one of the things that he told me that I kind of suspected must be true, but didn't really know for certain, is that there is now a consortium in Israel of no less than 44 peace organizations who have decided to work together as a coalition. And that is exactly what needs to happen today and is happening today. So, I would talk about Ofer as a person who is courageous enough to withstand the kind of existential panic that prevails in Israel. And he said, this was off the record, but I think I can repeat it here. He said he may well be assassinated for his beliefs, but he's not going to change them. And that's the kind, you know, I don't operate on that level. Nobody is out to assassinate me, but I don't think. But I found that extremely inspiring. And then if you go back in the past, gosh, there are so many people that I like to think about. I don't know why this particular one occurs right now, but he was a Catholic priest from Poland. His name was Maximilian Kolbe, and he was arrested by the Gestapo, and he was in the concentration camp. He was in Auschwitz, and the Germans offered him to release him on the grounds that he was Volksdeutsch, that is, ethnically German, because his name was Kolbe, which is German. He said, no, thank you, I'm Polish, I'm going to stay with my people. Then one day, a prisoner tried to escape, and he did actually make good his escape. And what they did in those camps was they would pick out 10 people and do away with them in a way that was, as you can imagine, not very pleasant. And I will not go into the details. But one guy is pulled out, and he broke down. He said, my children, my family, my wife, I'll never see them again. And then Kolbe did something absolutely remarkable. He walked, I got out of line, walked up to the commandant and said to him in perfect German, I have a favor to ask of you. Well, you can imagine how shocked this Gestapo officer is. And he said, yeah, what is it? And he said, I want to die in the place of that man. And so after a stunned silence, his wish was granted. And he did die. And you might think that, okay, this is a classic case of nonviolence not working. But later on, after the war, we find out that his sacrifice inspired thousands of people. And being inspired in a concentration camp was not just a feel-good thing. It meant a difference between life and death. If people got demoralized, they died in those circumstances. You had to somehow hold on to your will to live. So it is possible within reason. Science is just starting to catch up with us and starting to show us how nonviolence works. But we have to infer that this one act of sacrifice rescued hundreds, maybe a thousand people. So I find that very inspiring, and it really is a good illustration of the dynamics of nonviolence. Let me hasten to add, you do not have to die to practice nonviolence. Most of the time, if you act soon enough and smart enough, you don't even have to risk dying. But we have what we call in the meta center this escalation curve, where, you know, first section of the curve, you can talk to people, so you do, but then there's a point where they won't listen to you anymore. You go on to the second phase. And in the second phase, you have to carry out satyagraha, or nonviolent resistance. If even that doesn't work, you sometimes have to reach a point where you risk death. And for example, the way Gandhi would undertake a fast and say, I'm not going to eat until you guys stop this. And they did stop it. So the risk of the ability to turn your back on your own personal life has a tremendous power. Now, let me again add, more realistically, if you do this, if you intervene in a problem soon enough and you understand nonviolence accurately enough, it virtually never gets to that point. And there are really less than a handful of people who have died practicing nonviolence, to my knowledge, versus the tens of thousands who are dying as helpless victims or in the attempt to carry violence out.
That's a really helpful way to sort of think about it along that kind of continuum of arc. And I also would posit that there's a thousand things that people are doing in their everyday lives that are nonviolent activities. Yeah. They just haven't classified it as that. Like when they assume the best in their neighbor that everyone assumes is a jerk. That's like nonviolent liberation happening, right? Yeah. When someone wants someone else to assume the best in them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And sharing other people's stories and getting to know your neighbors and so many people classify it as just the like marching and protesting and the sit-ins. A lot of the tactics that worked for Martin Luther King Jr. and for Gandhi and for others, but they kind of forget that anything that makes it known that you're in the midst of a struggle and you need help can be one of those acts of nonviolence if you centered in your compassion place.
Oh, that's well put. That's well put. Yeah, and people, as you say, they often gravitate immediately. They want to do something. The first thought is, let's pick up a sign and protest. Let's go out and show them that they're wrong. And then they say, Gandhi did it. But what they neglect to say is he did that at like 10-year intervals. For 10 years, he was training people in spiritual disciplines in his ashram. He was spinning, doing constructive program, endlessly talking with the British in London, in India, in Simla, wherever. And so, his 30-plus year career was punctuated by a few protest marches, but not characterized by those marches.
It also makes me giggle a little bit when people always jump to like a sit-in or getting arrested for a thing that doesn't dramatize the issue. Like they forget people were sitting in places where it was illegal to sit. Like the sit-in had purposes and it had specific kinds of results, or they got so many people to sit in that it changed campuses. And these were really strategically planned actions, not actions in and of themselves that you just sort of replicate. And so I'm always really appreciative when people find creative, beautiful, artistic ways to kind of propel a message into the world and are, you know, sewing and making giant anti-Vietnam puppets and things like that help really liberate a message in a way that it makes it makes it palpable for new and other people.
Yeah. Or even feeding your cat.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, Megan, we have been, we, when I say we, this small band of nonviolent scholars, we have been systematically cataloging tactics, strategies and tactics. And Gene Sharp, who was kind of a pioneer in all of this, he came out with a well-known book, as well-known now, that listed about 300 tactics. Now, between you and me, I'm a purist. There's probably 30 or 40 of his tactics I would not use, but yeah, that's another matter. But since then, my friends at Nonviolence International in Washington, D.C., have established a database of over 1,000 episodes of nonviolence in history. It's called the Global Nonviolent Action Database. It's housed at Swarthmore College. And they are now doing the same thing. They're looking at those activities, those campaigns, and they're pulling out tactics. But the important thing is to know when to use which tactics and to know when you have to escalate. And almost all of the really expert people that we interviewed in our film stressed that, you know, just turn out in the street and protest or sit somewhere and get in the way or block traffic is often the last thing you should do. And there's 100 things you can do leading up to that.
Well, that's part of what I appreciate about the radio work that you do and the mm-hmm. publishing work and the mm-hmm. and the multimedia work that you all are up to is yeah. that you are very interested in helping people enter into pondering and living yeah. into what their own personal nonviolent journey might be or what their communal nonviolent journey might
yes.
be.
Yes. Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. Yeah, it is very much a question of recognizing our own nonviolence capacity and then growing it, which so that we recommend that people, you know, at the end of our film, we have kind of 5 things that you should do. Don't watch the violent media. Do watch nonviolent media like what we're doing right now. Learn about nonviolence and ground yourself spiritually in the way that we were talking about earlier. And then look around and find where your capacities meet the needs of the world. And then from there, it's again a question of feedback. Learn while doing. Yeah.
Well, if people are interested in learning more about how to connect with you or mm-hmm. with the Meta Center for Nonviolence, what's the best way for them to reach out yeah. and get connected?
Yeah, I think I'll say info@metacenter.org, and Meta has 2 T's. my work partner here, Stephanie, will be angry at me because that gets to her first and she has to be my firewall. But at least she can then keep track of it. So info@metacenter.org is the best. And our website is metacenter.org and also thirdharmony.org if they want to go directly to the book and the film and the board game.
Well, beautiful. I appreciate you and all of your time in this space, and I'm sure we'll connect again.
That is really good to hear, Megan. I appreciate you and your work as well. And by all means, let's look for a way to connect again.
We will. Thank you for listening to our conversation with Michael Nagler. I am so grateful that you made it through to the end, and I hope that this conversation has inspired you to live with kindness and compassion in the world. We certainly need it, and I know that I am grateful for all the ways that you try. If you don't manage to do it, I know even still, things will be well. I'm rooting for you, and hoping to lift up ways that we can all work together, seek wellness, and make it through to another day together. If you are interested in supporting conversations like these, please like and subscribe and do all of the things that people do. Leave nice comments and maybe share it with someone who you think would appreciate this conversation. And if you really want to help us move things along, you can help by supporting us on Patreon. Thank you, everyone, for all the ways that you have been so supportive to me. It really does make a difference. Take care, y'all.